from the question about Syria, Iran, Russia, and America to the war on gender. We've got it all coming your way today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I've wanted the dust to settle a little bit before talking at length about what's happening in Syria, American involvement, threats from Russia, Iran. Are we on the edge of a precipitous war, a World War III provocation or something, a war between the superpowers? Is prophecy being fulfilled? Scripture about destruction of Damascus? All these questions swirling, some religious, some just worldly, secular, but the dust is not settling. The dust is getting dustier. So we're going to weigh in. We're going to talk about this from a whole bunch of different angles. Welcome to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. Number to call 866-348-7884. Let me pose a few questions for you. Is this a good thing? President Trump bombing Syria, saying you crossed a line. You crossed a line. Bashar Assad, you crossed a line. President Obama said there was a red line. You crossed it. He did nothing. Well, you crossed it again. Well, I'm doing something because I'm not Barack Obama. I'm strong. And we're bombing this airfield to make it more difficult for you to launch another mission like this. Is that a good thing? Show of strength? Or was it premature? Because we don't even know for sure who's responsible for the attacks. Yes, we say we have intel for sure, blaming Syria, the leadership. Others say it was rebels behind it. Others are even claiming some conspiracy with Russia and trying to draw America in or blame Islamic radicals or whatever. So do we even know for sure? And then as horrific as it is, as galling and painful and unspeakable as it is to see people dying of apparent sarin poisoning and to see a father holding his two twins, his twin babies in his arms that died. As appalling as it is, are we supposed to get involved? There are atrocities taking place in different parts of the world on a regular basis. Boko Haram, some of the things they've done in Nigeria have been absolutely horrific. I mean, setting on fire a school with children inside of it, and a boys' school, and then kidnapping girls and all the horrors and atrocities they're committing. Why don't we get involved there? May not be chemical weapons, but why don't we start bombing them? I mean, when do we get involved? When do we not get involved? And then a further question. When you get involved in Syria, what are you doing? Who are you helping? There are some who say, as bad as Assad is, he protects the Christians, just like Saddam Hussein protected the Christians in Iraq. And when you get rid of the bad guys like Hussein and Assad, when you get rid of those guys, then it opens up a hellish attack on the Christians and others, and the suffering only increases and it destabilizes the region. So these dictators are bad, but what's worse is to get rid of them. Then you have a vacuum in power, and that's when an ISIS rises up. Or do we just concentrate on taking out ISIS and then leave the other Syrian rebels to fight with Assad and Assad with the Syrian rebels and let them determine where they're going? But then Russia's involved and Iran helps fund Syrian terror and Syrian rebels. And which way is it going? Are they supporting Assad or who's standing with whom? I mean, all these questions before us, do we just jump in? And what's the role of America anyway? Does America have a role of being the world's policeman? And when no one else acts, we act? I mean, would that have been right during the Holocaust, that if others didn't act, that we act? Would we have an excuse not to because others didn't? These are fair questions. I have some responses, and others, I have questions that drive us to prayer. So what do you think? Good thing or bad thing that we bombed Syria? And what's interesting is some of the staunchest supporters of Donald Trump, the Ann Coulters of the world, they're really upset saying, stay out. You're blowing it now. Stay out. You're losing my support with this. Stay out. We'll do our best to sort this out. What do you think? We get involved or not when atrocities are taking place outside of America? Is it our place to intervene? 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Also, Justice Gorsuch, why do I keep mispronouncing his simple name? Justice Gorsuch has now been sworn in as our ninth Supreme Court justice to make up for the death of Justice Scalia. We'll talk about that a little later in the broadcast. And if you somehow missed the news yesterday, ISIS has taken responsibility for two terror attacks on Coptic churches in Egypt. Many, many killed. It's appalling. You can actually watch the video where there is a suicide bomber. And in order to get into that building, they want you to go through a metal detector. And he walks in there, and that's when he detonates. So the next thing, see the explosion. And then inside another church, a terrible explosion. We posted on Facebook a link to jihadwatch.org, where they had footage from within the building moments after the explosion, blood everywhere, bodies, people. It's horrific. The building torn up. ISIS taking responsibility for this on what Christians celebrate as Palm Sunday. Yes, yesterday, Palm Sunday, celebrated by Christians around the world. And a Coptic Christian from Egypt contacted me on Facebook with a link, and I said, yeah, it's just horrific. And I said, is it the government not doing enough? And he said, look, the government is trying hard. It's overwhelming. And this is just something that Islamic terrorists do at this time of the year to Christians, attacking them. I think he linked 11 attacks at these times of the year in the last few years, gave me reference to those. So we want to pray for our brothers and sisters who are suffering. And again, when we get involved with a country like Syria, we want to ask all the questions. We want to ask all the questions like, what long-term results will our actions have? If we go into Syria, if we're successful in taking out Assad, Secretary of State Tillerson talking about, yes, regime change, and now trying to clarify more what the long-term goals are in Syria. Over the weekend, some claim confusion within the Trump administration. I think a lot of things are just happening quickly and are going to take a little time to sort out. But for sure, if we're going to go in with a coalition of other countries and do what we did in Iraq and remove Assad and then seek to raise up a democratic leadership, first, is the country ready for a democratic leadership? Does the country have the capability of carrying out a democracy? Does the country really want that? Is it sustainable in that culture? I mean, if you think, for example, someone like Mahmoud Abbas, elected by the Palestinian people to govern so-called West Bank, Judea, Samaria, to govern there as the Palestinian Authority leader. How long was he elected for? Was it 4 years? How long has he been in office without another vote? Yeah, that's what happens. There is the joke about democracies in Africa. As countries were moving towards democracy, that someone would get elected and then they just stay in because they were used to these dictators and folks that just took over, and that's how they operated. So the sad joke was one person, one vote, one time. Yeah, everybody gets to vote once. And once the guy's in power, they stay in power for decades. So what would actually happen if we help remove Assad? And this is different now than Iraq because of Russia's active involvement. Many would say because of the void of American involvement under the Obama administration, that gave room for Russia to get involved. Others would say, why do we have to be the ones involved all the time? What the Obama administration did was good in pulling out. There's a lot of debate about all these issues. There are others who are saying, hey, look at this. Look at this. This policy and the way the Trump administration is going, it's not being directed by the Steve Bannons of this world who were strategic, strong conservatives, right wing, who were strategic in getting Trump elected. No, it's Jared and Ivana Kushner. And they're the ones who are pushing this. And they are more moderate and more centrist and even more Democrat in their leads. I mean, this is the talk of what's going on. And that's what's pushing the Trump administration. God knows. God knows. But with Russia's involvement with Syria, there's no way that we could just go in and take out Assad without massive, massive repercussions. So the bigger questions are, do we get involved long-term in Syria? If so, on what level? If so, with what goals? And then the general question, is this. At what point do we get involved in other countries' struggles? 866-348-7884 is the number to call. I did a Twitter poll, as I often do when I've got questions to ask. One was, what's your take on Trump's bombing of Syria? And out of the 467 votes we got, there were four options. Good show of strength, unneeded meddling, acted too soon, or other. I couldn't think of a good fourth choice that would be different, hence other, to give people that option. Good show of strength was the winner with our Twitter poll. 55% of the people said it's good show of strength. 11% said unneeded meddling. 16% said acted too soon. 18% said other. Then I asked another question. By the way, if you haven't read my article, which was posted on Friday, in fact, I wrote it Thursday night, then I had to revise it, just add a line or two, because we bombed Syria. We hadn't bombed them at that point, so I had to revise just one little part of it, and then I sent it out to be posted. And it's on my website. If you go to thelineoffire.org and check out latest articles, you'll see it. Should we take out Assad? So we're right on top of these things, friends. We are your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Also, when you're at The Line of Fire, check out my newest videos, A New Way to Get Accepted to Stanford. Yeah, this is an eye-opener. And is it right to pray to Jesus, or do we only pray to the Father? Is it all the same? So those are all in our digital library, latest articles, latest videos on the website. Here's the other question I asked on Twitter. When atrocities are taking place outside of America, is it our place to intervene? 50%, of course. 13%, not our business. 21%, only with a coalition. 16%, only if it's a close ally. So 50% said, of course. The other 50% divided between not our business, but that was the smallest response. Next smallest, only if it's a close ally. And then only with a coalition, which means 66% either said, of course, or only if it's a close ally. 71% said, of course, or only with a coalition. Only 13% said, not our business. Here's my take. Here's my personal opinion. And you can weigh in with yours if you want to differ with me or add or take away from my position. 866-348-7884. My feeling is that unless we had absolutely certain intelligence that it was the Assad regime involved, that we had no business bombing. That's the first thing, and I think that's self-evident. Do I trust our intelligence system? With all respect to our intelligence officers, with all respect to the massive, massive work that is done, and even the dangerous work that's done by intelligence officials and servants around the globe. With all respect to that, I do not have deep confidence in our intelligence right now because it's so politicized, because there seem to be such divisions between the different organizations, and because some seem to be out to get Trump and others may be used to advance the Trump agenda. And we don't know if it's just impartial information. Now, I've read reports, websites accessing Arabic sources that say, hey, look, the day before the chemical attack, the night before, there are Arab sources, so sources in Arabic saying, tomorrow, get ready to announce this chemical weapons attack. In other words, tomorrow something's going to happen and everyone's going to blame the Assad regime for it. but actually it's rebels who are behind it. Others say it was a rebel facility that was bombed, and that's what happened. That it was an inadvertent attack. In other words, they didn't know there was nerve gas that it was going to affect others. I don't know. Okay, I lean towards assuming that we had sufficient intelligence, but I'm not sure. And what's interesting is that there's been a lot of liberal support for what Trump did. Okay, he took a stand, needed to do it. So, number one, the only way we should have acted is if we had absolutely foolproof intel that the Assad regime was behind the chemical attack. But I have some caveats after this. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Number to call. Isn't it interesting? Oh, by the way, next segment I'm going to be speaking with Brian Kammacher from Mass Resistance. I'm holding in my hands, two hands. It's a big book. It is, 600 pages? Yeah, 600 pages, just about 598 with lots of endnotes. And it's big. It's physically a big book. The Health Hazards of Homosexuality, What the Medical and Psychological Research Reveals. Why write a book on it? Why take all the time to compile this? Isn't this homophobic, hateful? We'll talk with Brian a little bit later in the broadcast. And then in the second hour, scheduled to speak with one of the most widely read bloggers, Christian bloggers, bloggers of any kind on the internet, Matt Walsh. He's got a new book. We'll talk about that as well. I'll have more to say about Justice Gorsuch. And as well, the question of, is prophecy being fulfilled in the Middle East? 866-34-TRUTH. FreeBeacon.com. Andrew Kugel reports, Democrats praise Trump on Syria military action. Democrats have offered their support and praise for President Donald Trump after he ordered a military strike against a Syrian air base Thursday night. Isn't that interesting? Trump's decision was met with praise by his opponents across the aisle. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer released a statement that applauded Trump's actions as the right thing to do. That's interesting. I mean, Trump does not get any praise from Chuck Schumer and from the Democrats in general. So why did this draw such praise from his critics? Michael Savage, this was a complete false flag event. A false flag event meaning something that happened that gives a false impression about guilt, about responsibility, producing the desired reaction to it. Michael Savage, who was a Trump supporter, said Assad had nothing to gain by gassing his own people. Now, in my article, again, you can read it on thelineoffire.org, should we get rid of Assad, or should we take out Assad? In point of fact, Ron Paul, former Congressman Ron Paul, made the statement that there's no way Assad would do this. He's been gaining ground, driving back ISIS. He's been retaking territory. Why would he gas his own people in the midst of this? To what strategic advantage and to what international advantage when there's just going to be outcry over it? Savage believes the symptoms witnessed in Syria are consistent with a phosgene gas, not the sarin gas widely reported. He stated the West jumped to a conclusion later added, we just helped ISIS. All right. So number one, my own view, we should have only acted if we had concrete intelligence that Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. That's number one. And from my vantage point, I'm a radio host. I do research. I have sources. People get me information. But you think I know more than the American intelligence? I know more than the people reporting on the ground in Syria? Any of us know more over here? No. So we're looking at the evidence. We're sorting it out. We're sifting. We're trying to evaluate. And we don't know for sure. All right. So I'm not convinced that our intelligence was sufficient. And again, what Ron Paul saying, what Michael Savage is saying, what others have said, I don't understand why Assad would do this. You say he's murderous. Yeah, he's murderous, but he's also a sly fox. Yes, he's murderous. Yes, he's a dictator. Yes, he's committed atrocities. Yes, he deserves divine judgment. Yes, to all of that. And maybe Syria would be better without him. I only say maybe because it all depends on who he's replaced by. If you could get the right leader, if you had someone who perhaps like General al-Sisi in Egypt, who seems to want to do the right thing to combat radical Islam and seems to have the support of his people. And even my Coptic Christian friend on Facebook felt that the government is trying to protect the Coptic Christians. Many would say they're not doing enough, but he feels they're against overwhelming odds and they are trying. All depends on who the leader would be, who the leader would be taking over Syria, or if there would be a single leader, if the nation would just fall into complete chaos and anarchy. That's why there's always a question, what happens when you remove the dictator? And some say, look, this is just a move to get rid of all the people Russia put in place years ago. You know, Gaddafi in Libya and Hussein in Iraq and Assad, his father, now the son, in Syria. And that's that one view. This is all us fighting against Russia. These are complex issues. So in my opinion, if we had certain intel that the Assad government was responsible for the attacks, then I believe it would be right to do what we did, but only that. In other words, we sent a warning and we said, I don't care if you're supported by Russia or whoever, you've crossed a line here and you've crossed it for the world to see. And there are going to be consequences if you do this again. However, I don't believe we can do anything beyond a strike like this because, one, we have the larger question of what will this provoke with Russia, secondarily with Iran, that's also threatening us, all right? But the one view is that we didn't do anything against Syria before, against Assad, because we didn't want to provoke Iran in the midst of the nuclear negotiations, which, of course, were, yes, Trump's right on that, the worst deal he's ever seen. So on the one hand, we don't care about Iran as much as Russia, but we understand their powerhouses. And do we want to unnecessarily provoke? No, let's be cautious here. It's horrific to see what happened in Syria. But there are a lot of horrible things happening all the time. And Nancy and I were talking about this over the weekend on Saturday. Why is this atrocity that much worse than, say, people being starved to death or people being tortured to death? In other words, because it's a weapon of mass destruction, I know it crosses a certain line. But what about all the other lines of atrocities that have been crossed for years and years and years and years all around the world? So if we're going to get involved, I believe then it has to be with the support of Congress, it has to be with an international coalition, and it has to be with a better plan than we had for Syria. Yeah, tall order. And even then, it's best to try to negotiate with Russia rather than just to say, okay, we're going to show our strength, you show your strength, because then there's going to be a whole lot of casualties. So the strike, if we had certain intel, that makes sense to me, just to send a signal. But beyond that, we better act slowly and cautiously, especially when so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost and so many millions have been displaced. Let's act wisely as we go forward and pray for the gospel to continue to spread through Syria, because many Muslims are coming to faith, and pray for God's grace on the suffering Christian communities there and elsewhere in the Middle East. Hey, friends, make sure you go to thelineoffire.org. When you stand with us as a partner, stand with us as a torchbearer, we're going to sow back into you in a way that will impact your life as well. Together, friends, we're making a difference. We'll be right back with Brian Kamiker.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Save the nation. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, friends, we are now changing from international issues to national issues to people issues to one of the great controversies in our society today, namely, how do we deal with the question of LGBT activism? Isn't this simply a matter of equal rights? Isn't this simply a matter of treating everyone with respect? Isn't this just the same as what we had to overcome, say, with days in America where we would not allow interracial marriage and we were bigoted and biased against people and we were pro-segregation or pro-slavery and we overcame those biases and we celebrate diversity? Isn't it the same with homosexual men and women? Shouldn't we just respect their lives, respect their marriages, respect their families? After all, some of your best friends identify as LGBT. Some of your own kids identify as LGBT. Some of your favorite celebrities identify as LGBT. Some of the nicest couples you've ever met, some of your best coworkers identify as LGBT. Aren't we being bigoted, biased, homophobic, transphobic to stand against their rights, to oppose equality? Isn't it wrong, especially for people of faith, to do this? Well, I'm going to speak now with Brian Kaminker. And Brian leads Mass Resistance. It began in 1995 in Massachusetts as Parents' Rights Coalition. And Mass Resistance now has been spreading to other states and even other nations. And they have now put out as a large reference book, The Health Hazards of Homosexuality, what the medical and psychological research reveals. Brian, welcome back to the Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, Brian, you get attacked, maligned, Mass Resistance, hated, rejected by many, and you couldn't have picked a more controversial subject than this one. There's a lot of research that went into it. It's expensive to produce a book like this. Why in the world get even more controversial and put out something that's going to even draw more hatred towards you and Mass Resistance?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, that you're really doing a public service to people on all sides of the political divide when you basically say, here's the truth that's been kept from you. What this book shows is not, you know, it's not opinion, it's fact. It's taken from the Centers for Disease Control, all of the major medical websites, medical societies, even the LGBT medical groups. And I think that part of the legitimate conversation has to be legitimate facts about what we're talking about. If there's the hate, all, of course, all comes from, you know, a certain political, the radical LGBT movement that doesn't want the public to know about this. But, you know, nevertheless, I mean, here in Massachusetts and other states, the state budget for, funding for LGBT-related diseases and behaviors is going up and up and up every year. The whole issue of, gay domestic violence is, you know, has its own budget item in the Massachusetts budget.
Mm.
And so I think for that reason, too, it's legitimate to talk about this. And, of course, you know, when you talk about hate groups, we all know that every single pro-family group, you know, national pro-family group in the country is now considered a hate group.
Got it.
So, you know, you can't get away from that.
Can't get away from that. All right, friends, we come back. We're going to continue to talk with Brian Kaminker. The website, massresistance.org, the new book, The Health Hazards of Homosexuality.
Cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today, 866-348-7884. I'm speaking with Brian Kamenker. He leads Mass Resistance based in Massachusetts, but working in different countries, working throughout America. The new book published by Mass Resistance, The Health Hazards of Homosexuality. Brian, I want to address some larger issues in terms of what Mass Resistance is doing around the country as well, because there are significant things taking place as parents stand up and fight back in terms of for what they believe is right. But just for the sake of our listeners, so they understand, Brian, you are Jewish, you're not a Christian, and yet you're working with folks, people of faith, people of non-faith, because issues are coming our way that we really can't avoid in our children's schools and even as you talk about public budget and things like this. So this is not an exclusively conservative Christian issue, is it?
Well, that's an interesting question. Most of the people that we work with are people of faith. And that generally happens. I mean, if you haven't been, once you get involved with this issue, you tend to become one. Just because of the whole, I mean, it's a real spiritual battle. And people who were never really very godly, you get involved with this for a while, and you have nowhere else to turn. But that's a whole different program. but you don't have to take this from a religious perspective to see the danger and the trouble and the issues involved. I mean, in the public schools, the promotion of just blatantly, unhealthy, destructive behaviors to kids, and some of these kids are very young kids, elementary school kids, is just ghastly. Parents see this, and you don't have to be religious to be very angry and very upset. It's done secretly. Parents who question it are treated very harshly. They're intimidated. They're harassed. They're called names. So this has become a big battle, and it doesn't have to be a religious battle. It's a battle.
Mm. And again, it's something that came our way rather than something we went looking for. So how did Mass Resistance begin? What was it that provoked you to get involved?
Well, back in 1990, the late 1992, some friends, a friends were meeting at someone's house, and somebody showed me a copy of the elementary school teacher's guide for their sex ed thing. And I had a child in the elementary school. And I looked at this thing, and it was horrible. I mean, it had all this very explicit homosexual stuff, things that I'd never seen. And I went to a school committee member and asked him about it. He goes, oh, this is what parents want. And we went to the superintendent, and he said, well, if you don't like it, send your kids to a religious school because this is what we're doing. And so we went to the school committee, and I questioned. I said, why are you doing this? And I started reading it. And they were very nasty. They said, your 3 minutes are up. If you don't, leave right now or stop this, we're going to have you arrested. And, it was completely inappropriate for what I was asking.
Mm. And you're talking about elementary school.
Right.
And when you say the curriculum contains stuff you hadn't seen, you meant as an adult. This was stuff that was offensive to you.
Yeah, and I mean, like dental dams and all this just ridiculous stuff. And then the school committee members went, I was interviewed in the newspaper, and the school committees, spread all these stories about me. Among other things, they said that I was a Christian fundamentalist when, as you noted, that I'm actually Jewish. And also the gay activists in Boston. Now, this was a suburb of Boston, but in Boston started getting involved with this. And it was, again, it was completely out of proportion to, you know, anything that was going on. Now, had the school committee just simply said, oh, this looks bad, we'll look into it, and they could have just really done nothing, and I would have said, okay, fine, you know, I'll wait to hear from you or something, and, you know, just walked my way. But they took this very hostile approach, and I noticed that they were doing it to other parents, too. And so we got involved. We, you know, we formed a parents group, and one thing led to another. We became a statewide group. And one of the interesting things is we wanted the school committee to allow parents to be notified if this is being taught, and they absolutely refused. They said, no, we're not going to do that. So we went to the state legislature, and after a 2-year battle, we got the state legislature to pass a state law allowing that. And through just the force of angry parents, and it's still the law in Massachusetts, and just one thing led to another, and it became just this large group that became statewide and is now national and even international. And as I said, had the schools been reasonable, I would have never, you know, really probably gotten involved that much. You know, but they wanted, you know, they were completely unreasonable. They attacked me personally, and they did that to other parents too, not just me. And this is what we see across the country. They, you know, they're very aggressive against anyone, parents or otherwise, who look into this, who question it. And people just had enough. And, you know, getting to this book, this is a 600-page book. It's huge. It took 3 years to write. And we worked, you know, we worked with a lot of medical people. And, you know, the underneath this veneer of respectability is really a terrible nightmare of problems surrounding LGBT behavior. You know, if you've ever seen a gay pride parade, you can certainly see that something is wrong, that normal adults don't do those things or carry on that way, you know, with the BDSM and the running around naked and all just that weird stuff. And then, you know, the other thing I talked to you about, the, you know, the diseases and the money necessary for it. And so this is a big problem. And to promote this with kids in the public schools is there's something really wrong here. And this information is being basically you know, withheld from the public, or maybe not withheld, but certainly depressed from being made public. And so this is why we came out with this book.
Right, so it's all from the same concern. It's all flowing out of the same issues that have been larger issues. So, Brian, are you, and allow me to play the devil's advocate here for a moment, are you denying that there are gay people who love each other, or that there are gay couples committed to each other? Are you saying that all gay couples are just like what you see in the gay pride parades, and that's the norm? Or are you not recognizing any love or commitment in the midst of these? Or are you simply saying it doesn't matter how loving or committed they are, this is still unhealthy?
Well, I think it would be the latter. I mean, What the research shows, and this is, you know, even the gay research, even the research on the gay sites, is that the relationships are innately unhealthy on a number of levels. There's, you know, a much higher level of domestic violence, all kinds of psychological issues, all kinds of, you know, pathologies, all kinds of addictions involved, and that this love is more of an addictive kind of thing. Now, we don't get into do they love each other or not love each other. I mean, that's something beyond. I mean, that the book doesn't address.
Mm-hmm.
What we're dealing with is the health issues of that behavior. And,
right.
You know, so
in other words,
it
would be a simple matter of it doesn't matter why someone smokes cigarettes. Smoking cigarettes is unhealthy, and therefore you don't promote cigarette smoking to children. You know, that
right.
would be something that simple. The person that is drinking heavily may be a very nice person, but it's dangerous to drink and drive, and it's unhealthy to drink heavily as a lifestyle. So again, this is simply, friends, what the book says, the health hazards of homosexuality, with the medical and psychological research reveals. So we come back. We're going to make this kid-friendly. I know many of you listen with your kids. We're going to talk about problems, results, as opposed to the details of certain acts and behavior. But how dangerous is this? We have warnings on packages of cigarettes. We post calories with meals. How serious is this?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on the voice of The Line of Fire, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. I'm joined by Brian Kamenker, who directs Mass Resistance, the website massresistance.org. The reporting there is disturbing, but it's necessary to read. It's like a bad weather report that's coming your way. Well, it's coming. You need to deal with it. And different chapters have been raised up in states like Texas, where parents, educators, others are standing up saying, hey, we have an issue with this agenda coming in our schools. We have an issue with these things being forced on our young people. We have an issue with the lack of balance in presentation, the lack of honesty in presentation, and we're going to stand up against this activist agenda. And they're making a difference. Mass Resistance is even helping in other countries dealing with the same activism. And Brian, it's never the question that you're dealing with is never should you treat your gay neighbor with kindness and respect? Should you get along well with your gay coworker? If your kid comes out as gay, should you be kind to your kid? Those are never the questions you're dealing with. You're dealing with an aggressive activist agenda that basically says we're coming out of the closet and we're putting all resistance and dissent in the closet. So again, folks, to get the full documentation, 600 pages, the health hazards of homosexuality, what the medical and psychological research reveals. And that's what it is, going point for point in various aspects of what would be more common in homosexual circles or in LGBT circles than in heterosexual circles and what the health risks are. So again, Brian, just without getting into details of specific acts and actions, let's talk about some of the larger health risks that are faced by those in the LGBT community. We can talk about from substance abuse to physical problems. We can talk about psychological issues, especially with transgenders. But dive in, give whatever examples you'd like.
Well, obviously AIDS and HIV is a huge thing. And failure to curb it, things like that. I mean, some of the things that the book talks about is the larger public health issue, the long list of diseases, not only HIV, but so many others, the STDs, all the various diseases that are involved. The psychological issues, depression, pathologies, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, substance abuse, partner abuse, the shortened lifespans, chronic conditions, lower quality of life, the various normalcy of behaviors like BDSM, sexual sadomasochism is a normalized behavior in that community. You see it at every gay pride parade. The dangerous sexual practices, how HIVs and other STDs are reemerging as an epidemic, the psychological and medical issues of transgenderism, and the lies about the so-called safer sex, the false optimism and the drug treatments. One of the things that's interesting is if you pick up a Catholic newspaper, you see ads of, various Catholic kinds of things. You pick up the Jewish newspaper, you see, various ads of Jewish things. if you pick up any gay newspaper, a preponderance of ads are of, you know, psychological treatments, you know, therapy sessions. You know, you'll have huge full-page ads of drug companies, all kinds of, you know, experimental drug treatments, things like that. It's overwhelming in those kinds of publications. If, you know, at these gay youth events that they have, like in Boston and other places, a major theme is get tested. You know, they have all this get tested for kids as young as 13 literature handed out, tested for HIV and other STDs. And at the adult things, they not only have the get tested thing, but the partner abuse literature. There's a problem here. This is very troubling. And this needs to be explored by the public. So that's what this book does, is it goes into, you know, all of these things. And as I said, it's from the, you know, Centers for Disease Control, the American Medical Association, all of the American Psychological Association, the various gay medical associations that are surprisingly honest about, you know, these kinds of issues. And I think that it's something that people need to know about, because when kids are told in the public schools that this is a normal behavior and you should feel, you know, comfortable about engaging in it, that they don't tell you the other part. They don't tell you, you know, just as when they say, well, maybe you're really transgender, maybe because you think you're a girl that you should take these puberty blocking drugs or something like that. They don't tell you that it causes lifetime sterility, and that it's, you know, cancer causing often, and that it does all of these horrible things to your body that they don't tell you about. There's some of that in the book too, but most of it, as I said, is here is what happens when you do these kinds of activities, and here are the kinds of activities that are, you know, very, very prevalent in that community. So it's a lot, I'll tell you. It's very overwhelming.
Yeah, and again, what's interesting, and I've even read articles from gay activists saying that you can't blame the higher percentages of substance abuse and depression and things like that. You can't blame them on a homophobic society, because a lot of it has to do with gay lifestyle, relationships, things like that. And in addition to it, even if you take all of that away, because God made men to be with women and women to be with men, when we deviate from that norm and engage in things that he didn't intend, the body wasn't made for that. And that's why you see a greater percentage of sexually transmitted diseases. And then what's even more disturbing is you see it especially among young men even under 20,
oh, yeah,
and minorities and things like that. So if we really care, we'll speak the truth. And Brian, I know, again, the flack that you take day and night, because I take it as well for the stance that I take. But if we really care, we'll get the facts out there. And we care about smoking. We care about drinking. We care about obesity. We care about other things. Well, do we care about the health hazards of homosexuality? Get this book, What the Medical and Psychological Research Reveals. You can get the ebook. I purchased the ebook as soon as it came out, and now Mass Resistance just sent me the amazing large paperback edition. And then go to massresistance.org. Help them, stand with them in what they're doing. And find out if stuff is happening in your own community, find out what others have done in other communities to make a difference and to speak up and to say, hey, we're parents, we're concerned, this is affecting our kids, we want to do the right thing. So, Brian, appreciate your efforts. I know it's a great challenge to keep going, but there are victories and there is forward progress. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be on your show.
All right. Again, massresistance.org is the website to go to. Friends, have you checked out my latest articles? Christians participate in the Passover Seder, latest videos, all on my digital library. Go to thelineoffire.org. From the question about Syria, Iran, Russia, and America to the war on gender, we've got it all coming your way today, right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There are prophecies in biblical books like Isaiah that talk about the destruction of Damascus, the capital of Syria. Is that something that happened many centuries ago? Is it something happening in front of our eyes? Is that something that will be a future event? We'll talk about that on the broadcast today. Just seeing news now, San Bernardino, an elementary school, a shooting, two reported dead, and suspected murder, suicide. You know, it's crazy these days. You hear that and think, oh, good, it doesn't look like a terrorist attack. Then, oh, good, it doesn't look like some demented mass murderer. It's just a murder, suicide. I mean, that's almost the way that you see reports like this. But San Bernardino, which was hit with a terror attack not that long ago, hit again with some traumatic news. May God's grace be there for the people of San Bernardino. I am about to introduce to you one of the most influential Christian bloggers online, Matt Walsh. He's got a brand new book, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. So we will talk to Matt in a few minutes. But first, if you missed the news, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was confirmed last week by the Senate, has now been sworn in as our ninth justice to fill the place of Justice Antonin Scalia. And it's interesting. The reaction against him is quite extreme. Planned Parenthood Cecile Richards said his out-of-touch judicial record, may I ask, out of touch with whom? Out of touch in which way? Out of touch with ultra-liberalism? Out of touch with radical progressivism? Out of touch with those who esteem the foundations of our country and the constitutional rights of America? Out of touch with them? His out-of-touch judicial record will threaten reproductive health and rights for decades to come. In other words, he will threaten the ability to kill millions of babies in the womb if he rules the way he's expected to rule on cases that come before him. That's the concern. He will threaten abortion activists. He will threaten abortion doctors and nurses. He will threaten Planned Parenthood's industry. That's whom he will threaten. The better way to have spoken of Gorsuch would have been this. His constitutionally based record will be a lifeline for the unborn in the womb. His constitutionally based history will be a lifeline for those who cherish religious liberties here in America. His constitutionally based record will be a lifeline for those who cherish the founding principles of our nation and believe that everyone, beginning in the womb, is entitled to the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. That being said, you never know which way someone will rule once in office. So we need to pray for a heart of justice and a heart of truth for Justice Gorsuch and for the others on the Supreme Court and for God's will in terms of who is replaced and by whom. We come back, we're going to speak with Matt Walsh, his new book, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. And Matt blogs regularly now for The Blaze, if you haven't read his blog.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, we are quite serious about a gospel-based moral and cultural revolution in America. We're not throwing in the towel. We're not saying it's too late. We believe it's time to stand up for what's right and to push back. One of the men who's been effectively pushing back for some years now, especially online, especially as an influential blogger, Matt Walsh, his new book, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. Back in 2004 is the first time that God started to lay on my heart that I needed to get involved with issues of LGBT activism. And I saw quickly that it had become the principal threat to freedom of religion, speech, and conscience in America. I saw quickly how far it had gone in media, in schools, etc. Became burdened about the issues, then became burdened about the people, and began to follow the philosophy, reach out and resist, reach out to the people with compassion, resist the agenda with courage. Of course, when you stand for these things, you get maligned, hated. When I went to publish my 20th book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, lo and behold, no publisher would touch it. Three subsequently apologized to me, but nobody would touch it. Too controversial. So when you're doing this, you don't find many other voices standing up clearly, because the moment you do, you get hated, vilified, you're homophobe, you're transphobe, you're worse, you're a Nazi, you're KKK, you're a bigot. So when I began to see some years back the Matt Walsh blogs, I said, look at this. He's putting all this time and energy into these blogs. They're terrific. They're getting read by hundreds of thousands, now millions of people. Now he has a book out, The Unholy Trinity. So I'm so glad for the first time to bring to the Line of Fire Matt Walsh. Hey, thanks for joining us, man.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Matt, how old are you?
I am 30.
30 years old. All right, so you represent then, you are a millennial voice technically, correct?
Yeah, unfortunately I'm still in that millennial demographic.
Got it. And you married, you have kids?
Yeah, I'm married. I've got 3 kids now.
3 kids, got it. So how in the world do you get involved in a battle like this, one in which you become maligned and hated and vilified just for taking stands? What is it that pushed you to action?
Well, I would say more than a what, it's a who. You know, I give all the credit to my parents who raised, I have 5 brothers and sisters, and we were raised in the truth, you know, in faith and in truth. And more than that, we were raised and encouraged to go out and engage the culture and to stand for our beliefs, even if we get pushed back, you know. And we went to public school, and so we found ourselves constantly, you know, our belief systems constantly being attacked and maligned. And we were always told that if you stand for what's true and what's right at school, that even if you get in trouble with your teachers or whatever, you'll never be in trouble at home if that's, you know, what causes trouble for you. So I was kind of raised into it. So in that way, I'd say it sort of had it easy, just in the sense that I inherited this fight. And you know, then that's one thing that I keep in mind now as I'm a parent, you know, with my kids.
And how have things shifted, say, since you were in school to today? Have things been on a steady moral, spiritual sanity decline in our culture?
Yeah, they were pretty bad when I was in school, and I think to some degree it has a little bit to do with where you are geographically, but the school system, no matter where you are, the school system is fundamentally hostile to so-called traditional values, Christian values. There's no question about that. And there was no question about it when I was in school. You know, I graduated, I got out of the public school system, you know, 13, 14 years ago. And from the look of it, and I haven't had direct experience with the public school system since, but from the look of it, it seems like it's only getting worse. And now when you inject this kind of gender ideology into the picture, which didn't really exist when I was there. Mm-hmm. But you inject that into it, you factor that in, and it's really gotten to the point in a lot of these schools where what they're teaching the kids is just completely divorced from reality, from truth, and it's pretty bad.
I saw on Twitter yesterday, and then I posted it on Facebook, a page from Amazon.com. It's a T-shirt, and actually there are bunches of different designs that says there are more than 2 genders, and then you can either buy men's size or women's size. There's something fundamentally contradictory when you just say that there are infinite number of genders, and we have to call it out for what it is. So how do you describe this, the transgender activism, the war on gender, part of this unholy trinity? What, in your view, is going on? How do you characterize this?
Well, I think this, in some ways, is kind of the last stage in the left war on objective truth. And in their attempt to instate relativism as the guiding principle of our society, because that's ultimately what they want to do. They want to live in a world where, you know, I have my own truth and my own reality, and I get to make up everything for myself. I am not subject to anything or anyone. There are no laws, no rules, nothing that can impose itself on me. That's what they the world they want to live in. And they began with their attempts to redefine human life 40 years ago. They were successful, at least legally speaking, in the courts. And then they moved on to marriage, and then on to gender. And once they're finished here, if they're able to succeed, and of course they'll never succeed in reality,
because right,
men are men, women are women, no matter what they do. But if they succeed just in terms of they fully normalize the idea that you can be whatever gender you want of any of the 5,000 options. If they succeed in fully normalizing that and getting society to fully adopt it, then that's sort of it. I mean, then there is no more truth left in our society. I don't know where you could go from there that would be any worse. I think we've sort of reached bottom at that point.
Right. Well, perception is reality. Bruce Jenner is a woman. Rachel Dolezal is black. The woman who believes she's a cat is a cat, and on and on. So perception becomes reality, in which case, how can you function as a society in any meaningful way? And if you declare war on gender successfully, you said in reality they can't, but that's how life goes around. So these things, in a sense, are self-destructive. So in your book, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender, you're putting three things together here and saying all part of the same battle. Abortion, the meaning of marriage, the definition of gender. Are these ideologically linked? Are they linked because you have the same activists behind them? Is this the Illuminati behind it? How are these joined together in reality?
Oh, well, I don't know about the Illuminati, but they're certainly certainly ideologically they're linked, in that there seems to be total unity on the, and then this is one thing that separates the left from the right, that on the left there's almost complete unity in terms of they all agree that these issues are important and they all believe the same things about them. And they kind of, it's kind of fascinating to watch as those on the left have adopted these views in succession and sometimes seemingly out of nowhere. So you look at 15 years ago, there certainly were a lot of people advocating for so-called gay rights, but it wasn't really even mainstream on the left 15 years ago. And even as recently as 8 years ago, we had the most radically leftist president in history who had to run on a platform of defending traditional marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was only 8 years ago. And we see how quickly that changed. And then the gender thing. Even 5 years ago, nobody was talking about this 5 years ago.
Yep.
They were complaining about gender roles just in terms of feminism and that sort of thing. But nobody was talking about how, you know, you could be whatever gender you want. The 52 genders, a lot of these were just invented in the blink of an eye very recently. And the left just kind of goes along with it. Whereas I think you find on the right, there is not that cohesiveness to it. And if you get 100 conservatives in a room and you ask them what are the most important principles to us, what are our foundational principles, I think you'll get 60 or 70 different answers. So that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, to kind of rally conservatives and Christians around these issues so that we can understand that our foundational principles are to protect life, marriage, and gender.
Yeah, and again, the foundations of our existence depend on these things. Matt, I noticed years ago in pro-life work that people protesting, you would have atheists, you would have gays and lesbians, and you'd have Satanists. And I remember thinking, why in the world these groups in such prominence, but there was almost a coalition against life, you could say. And this is almost a coalition against life and the foundations God has established. All right, we've got a break coming up, but Matt, what are you hoping that readers will get out of your book, Unholy Trinity?
Well, I'm hoping that they'll, first of all, come away with some clarity, understanding these issues, and as conservatives, understanding what the arguments are in our favor. So that, and then also, as I said, I want to galvanize and unify people, Christians and conservatives, around these issues, and to understand that we cannot move forward and argue about any other issue until we've established that life is sacred, marriage is sacred, and that men are men and women are women. And these are foundational things, ideas. We need to be able to establish and protect them.
All right, friends, we'll be right back with Matt Walsh, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. I can't tell you how many times I was about to write on something. I thought, awesome. Matt already covered it in great depth. He's articulate. He's clear. He's fearless. You need to read what he writes.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. My guest, Matt Walsh, one of the leading Christian bloggers online. You can read his blogs at theblaze.com. His book, new book, which is getting a lot of immediate attention, a lot of very positive attention, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. Matt, a few specifics. Why is abortion the crowning achievement of liberalism?
Well, you look at the power that they assumed for themselves, that they won through abortion. You know, if we're going back to the beginning of the discussion, the left's ultimate goal is relativism, is the rejection of objective truth. And so with abortion, they've started right at the beginning by making human life itself relative. Human life, according to the pro-abortion person, human life, the humanity of an unborn child, is relative to how the mother feels about it, relative to how convenient that life is to those around it. And so they have given themselves power over life and death. Not just life and death, but, you know, they can take humanity away from somebody, from their child, from a human person, just because that life isn't convenient to them. And so in that sense, you know, they're never going to achieve anything greater than that. And when I say greater, I don't mean good. I mean of more magnitude mm-hmm. than that.
All right, so that assault has been in place for decades now. The rhetoric surrounding it continues to get more and more shrill, especially as there's pushback on the conservative end. How do you think gay activists and their allies were so effective in getting marriage redefined, where now you have tens of millions of Americans saying, yeah, you have the right to marry the one you love? Yeah, as long as it's love, love wins, and it's all equality, why not? How were they so successful in marketing such a bizarre proposition that two men or two women can, quote, marry?
Well, I think there were many things that went into it. First of all, they were able to kind of set the terms for the argument, for the discussion, and we allowed them to do that. So they framed the discussion as one of it's about rights, it's about who's allowed to love who, that sort of thing. And once we allowed them to frame the argument that way, and when I say we allowed it, I mean we as in Christians were either ineffective in arguing against it, or we didn't even try, and we were just quiet. And so they framed the argument this way, and once they were able to frame it that way and get away with it, it was kind of game, set, match at that point. Once they were able to frame it as a discussion about rights, you know, rather than what is right, but human rights, then we were in trouble. But I think you take it back even further than that, because as I said, Christians were ineffective at defending marriage against this assault, or didn't even try in the first place. And part of that reason is because you have to trace, you know, the decay of the marriage covenant in American culture didn't start with gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to trace it back decades and decades and decades. And Christians abandoned marriage as a covenant, as a monogamous, permanent covenant between man and woman, they abandoned that notion, you know, 40 years ago or
right.
more. And once we had done that, then it was, you know, sort of difficult to make the argument that marriage is sacred. Meanwhile, we're going out and getting, you know, 5 divorces and getting remarried left and right, treating marriage as this frivolous, superficial, impermanent thing. And so it was really easy for gay activists to just point at us and say, are you people serious? You want to, you're pretending that you think marriage is sacred? Look at you. And, you know, that even if we are hypocrites about it, and we are, that doesn't mean we're wrong mm-hmm. about what we're saying in regards to gay marriage. But still, anytime the other side can look at you and accurately accuse you of hypocrisy, that's going to be an effective bit of ammo that they have in their arsenal, and they used it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've said for many years that no-fault heterosexual divorce in the church did more to undermine marriage than all gay activists combined. But we're saying both are wrong. Yeah, you pointed the finger at us, rightly so. Both are wrong. Redefining marriage is wrong, and losing the sacredness of marriage is wrong. Matt, you've got little kids that you're raising. You're calling for conservatives, for Christians to stand together and push back against this unholy trinity. Do you have hope that change can come? Do you have hope that your kids can be raised in a world that is more sane than the world that we live in today?
I don't have a lot of hope that my kids and their generation will be raised in a more sane world, because they're already living in a world that's even less sane than the one that I was raised in. And, you know, for it to all of a sudden become more sane, we'd have to have a very sudden change. A 180 would have to happen culturally mm-hmm. pretty much overnight. And that's not going to happen. I do have hope, ultimately. I have the ultimate hope, the spiritual hope, in that I know that the good guys win in the end, end of all things. So I have that hope. And that's the only real hope that we need. But in a more kind of temporal sense, I think there is hope of sort of turning the culture back towards God, but that's going to be a gradual process. And my kids and their generation are going to be very much involved in fighting to make that turn. You know, it's not going to be made before. They're going to have to be involved in turning it back. And so I have to equip them for that. And we have to be in it for the long haul. This is a generational. We lost the culture over a course of generations. And I think it stands to reason that if we're going to win it back, it's going to happen over generations as well.
Right. So we live with expectation of the Lord's return and looking forward to that day. But we have a multi-generational mentality until that takes place. And just as you were raised when you started off by saying it's not what prompted you to get involved, but who, raised by godly parents. Now you, in turn, are raising your kids in this way. So we, in that sense, can be holy counterculture revolutionaries by following the principles of Jesus. And Matt, I believe that gay activism effectively defeats itself because it overplays its hand. Those that were bullied become bullies, and then things keep going further and further with now name your gender and so on, whereas God's ways produce life and God's ways are best. So Matt, appreciate all your work again. The new book, The Unholy Trinity, Blocking the Left's Assault on Life, Marriage, and Gender. We've just got about 45 seconds. What are you hearing from the readers of your book?
I'm hearing, you know, I've been thrilled and humbled and very grateful for the positive response. People have actually read it. And I, you know, as I said, humbled by that. I think a lot of people feel alone, and they look at these issues, particularly with respect to marriage and gender, and they feel like, I'm not allowed to talk about this. You know, my point of view is just extinct. Nobody feels this way anymore. And so they read a book like this and they realize that they're not alone and that these are important issues. And I think that they feel motivated by it. So I feel pretty good about that. And of course, there are a lot of liberals who hate the book, but most of them, it seems, haven't even read it. So not to worry about that.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, appreciate your work, Matt. Thanks for joining us on the air today.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution.
Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. I am delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884, the number to call. I've got a brand new article. I wrote it just a few hours ago to make sure we had it up today. It's called, Should Christians Participate in the Passover Seder? Tonight, Jewish men and women around the world, it's already happened in Israel, but happening soon in America, they will join together for the annual Passover Seder. This is a traditional meal that commemorates the Exodus from Egypt and looks forward to the final redemption. And each element of the meal has a certain symbolism to it. And some of these elements or some of the concepts were certainly present in Jesus' day, and some were developed afterwards. And there's the question, well, is it right for Christians to celebrate this? So I've got a brand new article. You can read it at thelineoffire.org. And I hope to get into some of that with you as well. 866-348-7884. I was asked a question by a grad this morning who texted me. And he said, do you think what's happening in the Middle East today is prophecy being fulfilled? I mean, after all, you got some major players involved. You don't just have the fact that Israel is always in the middle of whatever's happening in the Middle East, which you can't get far away from physical Israel and from its relationship to the surrounding nations. But you've got America in the thick of this battle over Syria. You've got Russia involved. You've got Iran involved. And you've got potentially an international coalition of nations that could be concerned about what is happening in Syria. So, these are major questions. Is prophecy being fulfilled? You said, well, what prophecy in particular? Well, maybe a verse like this, Isaiah 17, passage like this, an oracle concerning Damascus, Damascus being the capital of Syria. Some of your translations will talk about the Arameans, others the Syrians. It is the same people. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins. The cities of Aroer are deserted. They will be for flocks, which will lie down and none will make them afraid. The fortress will disappear from Ephraim, which is northern Israel, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts. And in that day, the glory of Jacob will be brought low, and the fat of his flesh will grow lean, and it shall be as when the reaper gathers standing grain, and his arm harvests the ears, and as one gleans the ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim, gleanings will be left in it, as when an olive tree is beaten, two or three berries in the top of the highest bough, four or five in the branches of a fruit tree, declares the Lord God of Israel. And that day, man will look to his maker and his eyes will look on the Holy One of Israel. You have a passage like Jeremiah 49, beginning verse 23, concerning Damascus, Hamath and Arpad are confounded, for they have heard bad news. They melt in fear. They are troubled like the sea that cannot be quiet. Damascus has become feeble. She turned to flee in panic, and panic seized her. And then it goes on, I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus. It shall devour the strongholds of Ben-Hadad, the historic royalty there in Syria. Well, Jeremiah delivered his prophecy, what, 150 years after Isaiah's prophecy, roughly? Same prophecy, different prophecies, one still future. Is the Bible talking about modern Syria today? I want to address that when we come back, and then more to share with you today on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. If you have any question whatsoever about what's happening in the Middle East, about American involvement, about Trump policies, about what's going on, any question of any kind, I'd be delighted to talk to you. Give me a phone call. How? 866-348-7884. We'll be right back.
Flame, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire. 866-348-7884 is the number to call, especially if you want to weigh in with a Middle East-related question or comment. Again, my latest article, you can read at thelineoffire.org. Should Christians participate in the Passover Seder? We've got a few new videos up there, too, a teaching video. Is it scriptural to pray to Jesus, or do we just pray to the Father, or is there a difference? And then how a young student got accepted at Stanford University. Oh, yeah, that's a surprise. You'll read that. You'll find it interesting. All right, so when I read Isaiah 17, with my background in Old Testament and ancient Near Eastern studies, I look at Isaiah 17. I say, well, that happened. That was a prophecy about something that happened in Isaiah's day. And surely enough, when I take out the NIV Cultural Study Bible, I see the note there by Professor John Walton, the Syro-Ephraimite War, which raged during the middle 730s BC, this is Isaiah's time, end it with the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser invading Syria and Israel and devastating both of these rebellious states. That was from 734 to 732 BC. The Syrian kingdom, ruled from Damascus by Ritzin, had been Israel's principal political and economic rival. He had meddled in Israel and Judah's internal affairs and had encroached on their territories for over a decade. It seems apparent, however, that Ritzin overstepped his bounds in leading an anti-Assyrian coalition. Assyria did not welcome a rival Greater Syria, and the destruction of Damascus in 732, as recorded in the Assyrian annals, was massive. It left hundreds of sites looking like hills over which the flood has swept. This widespread destruction also included both the reduction of much of the city of Damascus to rubble, as well as the redistribution of its territories in Syria, Transjordan, and Galilee. So in other words, the prophesied destruction of Damascus happened. You say, but it could be happening again in our day. Could be, but that's not what Isaiah was addressing. Here, think of it like this, all right? Let me just help you understand biblical prophecy some. There are events which clearly describe the end of the age, all right? The end of days, the end of the age, and at this particular time, this will happen. It'll be the final judgment. It'll be the final establishing of the Messiah's kingdom on the earth. We understand that. But a lot of what the prophets prophesied, much of it, most of it, was to their people about things happening in their day with warnings and with promises, and we learn from that and apply that teaching to our day as well. So let's just say that you are a modern-day prophet, okay? You are a modern-day Isaiah. And 10 years ago, you said, a man will be raised up to be the president of our nation who will be very liberal. He will have a black father and a white mother, and he will turn America in a new direction in terms of marriage and family. And after him will come an unlikely president who will be known as a narcissistic businessman, and he will be a champion of the pro-life movement. Okay, who would I be speaking about? Well, obviously, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, right? If I'd prophesied these things 10 years ago. Okay, so go back to Isaiah's day, 730-plus years ago, and Syria is joining with the northern kingdom of Israel to attack Judah. And this is where Isaiah is based, in Jerusalem and Judah. And he's prophesying from there. All right, you read about it in Isaiah 7, this coalition that's coming against the Judean king Ahaz, and they want to get rid of him and put somebody else on the throne, basically replace the son of David, the Davidic king, on the throne and put someone else in place. And Isaiah says it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Northern Israel is going to be destroyed. In fact, they went into exile. They were exiled by the Assyrians in 721 BC. And Damascus is going to be destroyed. Well, that happened in 732, a decade earlier. So all that to say that what Isaiah said happened within a few years. He prophesied it, and it happened. Why would we now point that to the distant future. All right. And even if the prophet said that the city will lie in rubble and will not be rebuilt, it doesn't necessarily mean that it will be 100% devastated and no one will ever live there again. And it could mean generations will go by without it being rebuilt. When we get to Jeremiah chapter 49, again, the question is, what was the application in that day? So I take out my NIV Cultural Study Bible, which you can still buy from our website, I believe, at AskDrBrown.org. Otherwise, it's available elsewhere. And again, Jeremiah 49:23, which I read before the break, the capital city of Aram, Syria, from about the 10th to the 8th centuries BC, is Damascus. So in this context, the name represents the entire nation. When the prophet speaks of Damascus, he's speaking of the nation as a whole, Syria. Damascus was a constant threat to the northern kingdom of Israel until it was defeated by Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria in 732 BC, as we just said. So what happens is about 150 years go by. Now that the Assyrian Empire has collapsed, all right, and it's a little less than 150 years go by, Babylon is raised up. The notes here said that Damascus seems to have gained a degree of independence that was short-lived. So they seem, okay, we're free again, we can do what we want, and no, there's more judgment coming on you. It's coming again on you. And that's what Jeremiah predicts. After the Babylonians defeated the Egyptians in the Battle of Carchemish in 605 BC, effectively sealing Syria's fate, Damascus came under Babylonian control. And by 599-598 BC, the Syrian army joined the Babylonian army to begin a series of attacks on Judah. So once again, Syria is coming after Judah. Once again, Syria is hostile to Judah, and that could fuel the fires of this word of judgment. And what happens is the Babylonian Chronicle reports that Nebuchadnezzar intercepted the Egyptians at Hamath as they fled from Carchemish in 605 BC, and it goes on with further details. But in other words, there's further judgment that was prophesied on Damascus, on Syria, because of its ongoing hostility to Judah. And just the end of the notes, the expression, the fortresses of Ben-Hadad must be understood in the same way as one understands the house of Omri to refer to the northern kingdom of Israel, or the house of David to refer to the united kingdom of Israel. Ben-Hadad here is synonymous with the Syrian royal house. Okay, hope that wasn't too detailed for you. But the point I want to make is that there was application from that time. It would be odd if Jeremiah gave this prophecy, oh, let's just pick a date, 600 BC, all right? That he gives this prophecy in 600 BC, and it has no relevance to his day, no relevance to the decades that follow, no relevance to the centuries that follow, but now 2,700 years later, it becomes relevant with a prophecy about the destruction of Damascus, either by the United States or by a coalition or whatever. So, no, I don't see the prophecies unfolding like that. There are some that are decidedly end times. There are many prophecies that God gave to Israel that unfold gradually. So the first level of fulfillment is when? Say the exile from Babylon in the 530s BC. Okay, was it fulfilled? Did everything God promised happen then? No, there's more to happen. And we're seeing it fulfilled in our day as God continues to bring Jewish people back to the land in a state of unbelief, continues to bring them back to the land, and there in the land sprinkles clean water on them. So little by little by little, there's the turning of Jewish people to faith in the Messiah and faith in the God of Israel. And we see that it is a Jerusalem that does not believe in Jesus the Messiah that will be surrounded by hostile nations at the end of the age and attacked, according to Zechariah the 12th chapter. We see that that will happen, all right? And as a result of this happening, the great pressure that comes and the Holy Spirit working and I believe a positive witness of the church worldwide, that will create a turning of heart and that will lead to the Jewish people looking on the one they've pierced in mourning and repentance. But again, for that prophecy to be fulfilled, it requires an international coalition of nations coming against Israel, either all nations or an international coalition or all surrounding nations coming against the Jewish people in Israel, God fighting for them. But at that point, as a nation, they are not yet fully believing in Jesus the Messiah, to the point that a great spirit of repentance is poured out on them, and then cleansing comes to the nation. So all that to say, there are prophecies that I see still unfolding, but there are other prophecies which it's best to see. This happened in a certain historical context and has already been fulfilled. We'll be right back.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hi, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about Passover. Seder, which means order, it is a meal that traditional Jews celebrate, and it will be celebrated now tonight, the Passover meal. Even many non-traditional Jews will gather for this meal. Even secular Jews might celebrate it around the country. I celebrated it some growing up. I don't think every year that we had a traditional Seder, if my memory serves me right, but I know a number of years growing up I did. Again, I did not have a traditional Jewish upbringing. But many Christians have become interested in the Seder. Many Messianic Jews, like my friend Scott Volk, will conduct seders, and some have called it Christ in the Passover or Messiah in the Passover meal. And they'll point back to the Jewish roots of our faith, and they'll point to the significance of the various elements in the Seder meal. And because of that, an article was written, published by Christianity Today, by Rabbi Yechiel Pupko and David Sandmel. And these are men who celebrate Jewish-Christian dialogue. They call for mutual respect between the faiths, but they say, look, have respect. This is a traditional Jewish meal. And whatever Jesus said at the Last Supper with his disciples, it wasn't the same meal, because much of what's in this meal and the symbolism of this meal comes later. It was developed in the decades and centuries following the time of Jesus, Yeshua. And therefore, it's kind of Christians co-opting this when they make it their own. So, number one, Jesus did not participate in the Passover Seder. Whatever meal he ate that was the Jewish meal at Passover was different, did not have all the elements of the meal today. And secondly, it's inappropriate and disrespectful for Christians to have their own Passover Seder, since it's taking something that's sacred to Judaism and then turning it into a Christian event. You say, but what if you're curious as a Christian? Well, the rabbis would say, well, then maybe you have a Jewish friend. A Jewish friend would gladly have you as a guest if you want to learn and sit there and partake of a Seder with Jews. Or maybe ask the local rabbi, can you do some teaching on this? There are folks in our Christian community that are curious to know about this. Then gladly they'll do that. But don't make it your own Christian celebration, especially a Messianic Jew leading it. So this article got a lot of pushback on Christianity Today. A lot of folks were surprised by it and offended by it. And the question is, how do we respond? So again, my latest article, it's up now on thelineoffire.org. Should Christians participate in the Passover Seder? So here's my first question. How many churches are doing this? How many churches are having Passover Seders where they have everyone come together, not in the home, but at the church building or an event center, and they get hundreds of people together, a dining hall, hotel ballroom, and they have these events? I would suspect that the churches that are doing them are doing them in conjunction with a Messianic Jew, a Jewish believer in Jesus, who is now going to conduct the Seder and talk about the spiritual meaning and significance of the Seder. And I think that's the biggest rub for these rabbis who are saying, look, you've got this other group co-opting this event and making it into something that it is not. And how would we feel? How would we feel if for example, Muslims said, okay, communion now, we celebrate communion, but we see in it a prophecy about Muhammad, right? That's how we understand it. We see communion as a prophecy of Muhammad. Well, here's the problem. Muslims don't believe in the crucifixion of Jesus. And my comparison breaks down, right? Muslims don't believe in the crucifixion of Jesus, but all Christians believe in the Passover celebration, beginning with the Exodus from Egypt and culminating in the death and resurrection of the Messiah. So that's the first thing. Secondly, Muhammad has no connection with communion, but Jesus did celebrate a traditional Jewish meal at the Last Supper. Whatever Jewish people of his day did, that's what he did. That's what we glean from the Last Supper, from the drinking of the cups of wine and from things that happened there, and for the presence of the bread, which we understand would have been matzah, unleavened bread, and the wine to drink, that this was part of the traditional meal of that day. So even though not all the elements seem to have been there in Yeshua's day, he did participate in the traditional meal of his day, and that's what followers of Jesus are doing today, as he did in his day. And in doing so, they are appreciating the connection to the Exodus from Egypt. They are appreciating the symbolism of the bitter herbs, speaking of the bondage that we suffered there and things like that, and the bone from the lamb reminding us of the lamb that was sacrificed. But we say it's not just deliverance from Egypt. There is a greater deliverance and a greater Passover lamb. And that's what we're pointing to. And let's also remember that many Messianic Jews grew up celebrating the Passover Seder. And then once they came to faith, the Seder took on much more meaning for them. So when I was just at Beth Hillel, Messianic congregation, maybe about 500 people right outside of Atlanta, Roswell, Georgia, they were announcing the Passover Seder, when it's going to be. They're doing it because they're Jewish believers and they're Gentile Christians joined to them who celebrate this as part of a common heritage, recognizing roots, and even find within it symbolism that points afresh to Jesus the Messiah. And let's also remember, friends, that when the church cut itself off from its Jewish roots, anti-Semitism entered like a flood and has had a destructive effect on the world and hurt Jewish people and has blemished the church for centuries. To the extent the church rightly is connected to its Jewish roots and rightly celebrates things like the Passover, to that extent it will keep anti-Semitism from raising its ugly head. By the way, credit to Christianity Today. They published a full-length response to the article by the two rabbis, by my friends Mitch Glazer and Daryl Bach, entitled Why Christians Can Celebrate Passover Too. And they write, the question of whether or not Jesus celebrated the Passover Seder as we know it today is to some degree moot. He observed the Passover in the same way as any other first century Jew. This event can draw Jews and Christians closer to one another rather than driving an additional wedge between our faith communities. So what concerns them is when Christians do not see any identification with the Jewish people and the Jewish backgrounds of their faith. But more to the point, we simply cannot rob Christians of their heritage in Jesus, especially not the events of the Last Supper, which was clearly some type of Passover celebration. Having said all that, friends, can I call your attention to Egypt, where dozens of our brothers and sisters were slaughtered yesterday by ISIS terrorists, by suicide bombs that took many lives and left many more terribly wounded. And it was also a direct attack on the Coptic Pope, the leader of the Church of Egypt. So our brothers and sisters are suffering. These attacks are all too common in Egypt at this time of the year. A Coptic Christian there said he thinks the Egyptian government is doing what it can to stop this, but it's against overwhelming forces. Let's pray for grace for the believers there, as if this was happening to our friends and family. Let's pray for courage to stand. Let's pray for the exposing of Islamic terrorism and for the conversion of Islamic terrorists, that they too would turn to Jesus and that moderate Muslims would be appalled and look to the Lord as well. Friends, check out latest article, video, and our special resources at thelineoffire.org and partner together with us, because together we're making a difference.